for someone convenient to blame. You can take your pick, it's one or the other. DNA. RNA to the ribosome to make more protein. And while it's killing you dead, it will mess with your head. And it's the light in the dark that will guide you. It's the pages and pages of what you are like in the giant book that's hidden inside you. DNA.
Everyone, welcome again to Splice, Dominican's one and only science variety show, here from 6 to 7 every Monday night on radio.dominican.edu. You just finished listening to Camera Roll with Lady Madonna, and now for our fourth show of Splice. We're getting up there. We're going to continue talking about genetics, and this time we're going to cover the entire story of molecular genetics. It's going to be the very basis of genetics, and which helps feed into some of the things we talked about last show. Also, we'll discuss the news of the world, talk about the Nobel Prizes awarded just recently, cover chemistry and physics, as well as mention one thing I embarrassingly forgot about the winner of the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine. We'll also hold Journal Club Junior to talk about my favorite scientific article of the week, this time from Nature, one of the most famous journals. So, our tale begins with DNA. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. That's deoxyribonucleic acid. DNA is composed of a long sequence of nucleotides. There are four types of nucleotides which code for every different protein within our body. These four nucleotides are very picky in their partners. In fact, each nucleotide only binds with another nucleotide, a very specific one of the four. So adenine binds only with thymine, and cytosine only binds with guanine. So A binds with T, C binds with G. So if you're ever watching a TV show or a medical show and they bring up this huge long sequence of someone's DNA and point out this mutation somewhere, or maybe even in the X-Men showing that this part's different and you see this just long string of letters, that's what they're talking about. That's that sequence of nucleotides. There are around 30,000 genes in the human genome. These 30,000 genes cover the myriad of proteins that we make. And for those of you out there who might be doing some mental math, those crazy biologists, you might say, well, we have more than 30,000 types of proteins. And you would be right. These genes, while they encode for proteins, have various changes that can be affected later downstream from the actual code of the DNA. And we'll talk about those a little bit later. So be patient. On that same note, these 30,000 genes only make up around 5% of the DNA, which actually gets coded into proteins. The rest of the DNA area are non-coding or interon regions. So interon regions are regions within a gene which goes into mRNA but are later snipped out and not included in the final translation into proteins. And changes with specific snipping of interons or arrangements or what is considered an interon can affect what proteins are made from a DNA sequence. So, a little bit more about DNA in the actual cell, what it would look like beyond the molecular structure of the four nucleotides. DNA is a generally tightly wound during into chromosomes during mitosis. So if you think back to maybe you've seen them in pictures or something like that, when people think of DNA, they might think of these little X's formed by this tightly wound DNA. However, most of the time the DNA unravels and has kind of this spaghetti-ish mixture in within the nucleus as chromatin. So this chromatin actually helps regulate what proteins are made by the way it unravels. So this chromatin is actually wound around histones, and these histones can undergo modifications such as methylation, and these changes to the histones actually control the regions of DNA available to binding and expression at any time. So when you look at DNA, it's not the sort of stagnant one-shaped molecule, but rather this constantly fluctuating structure, which helps determine what parts of the DNA are exposed and what parts aren't. So even though a sequence is there within the DNA itself, it might not be accessible for translation in the cell. It could also explain why a cell might have so much more DNA than it could possibly translate, because so much of it is bound up around these histones. And this further could explain sudden evolutionary changes where a new region is added and then another trait or characteristic coded for in the DNA is then bound up instead and not made available for translation and thus becomes repressed. So it could explain to some extent why we might have the genes to have tails, but we do not. And this also affects stem cell differentiation, which we will talk about in detail with a special guest next week. Really special guest, promise, we'll be here. Very interesting. Tune in next week for stem cell genetics. It'll be a great show. Speaking of these changes to DNA and what's available and what's not, These arrangements are actually termed epigenetics. Epigenetics are genetics about which the actual structure and coding of the DNA does not determine. So epigenetics are traits which, if we had the entire genome sequence and understood it perfectly, we could still not really understand well. So epigenetics include methylation, in which methyl groups attach to the DNA and inactivate portions, and by inactivate, I mean it prevents certain transcription factors from binding and thus prevents the expression of that sequence. As well as what I talked about earlier, it could cause histone modifications. So, moving up one level from the DNA, we have transcription factors. Transcription factors are the factors which influence what portions of exposed DNA are expressed. And by expressed, I now will introduce a new term, mRNA. mRNA is messenger RNA. It is a similar structure to DNA in that it also has four nucleotides. And these four nucleotides also mirror the nucleotides of DNA. So once again, you have cytosine binding to guanine, and guanine binding to cytosine, and thymine binding to adenine, but you also have a new player, and instead of adenine binding to thymine, you have adenine binding to uracil. But same for your little mental scorecard, they're same in most regards, and this means that when RNA is made, it can serve a similar function to DNA in that it codes for proteins. So, transcription factors, the cell receives a signal which either causes the DNA to unpack or keeps the DNA from packing. These genes become available, and then at priming sites, transcription factors attach to the DNA, zip along the DNA, and spit out a copy of RNA, which corresponds to the DNA. So you kind of think of it as a cellular photocopy machine or fax machine. So you're just making a duplicate in a slightly different version that you can send outside the nucleus for later. So these transcription factors help to create transcription and substitution complexes. These are the complexes which actually cause mRNA to be formed. From this beginning site, the DNA into the mRNA creates this long strand, which is identical, but kind of the reverse of the DNA. So that means that you have a blueprint that you can send out later. However, that is not the end of the story. That is a rough draft of what becomes a protein. The mRNA is then processed. Sections are removed, as mentioned briefly earlier. So introns are removed and exons are kept or removed, depending on the cell type and what proteins are being made and what transcription factors and what spliceosomes. Spliceosomes are little bubbles of cutting enzymes which take sections out of DNA and then put some together, and is part of the origin of the name of your show you're listening to, Splice. So these spliceosomes help control what remains in the mRNA. Also, a cap and tail are added to the mRNA. It's believed that this helps stabilize the mRNA and allow the cell to better recognize mRNA sequences. Great, so now we have this rough blueprint copied from the main reference and then edited down and sent finally out of the cell. RNA molecules are moved into the cytoplasm. However, the danger is not over for them. Actually, these RNA molecules have many other ways they can be foiled before finally expressing their protein. mRNA molecules are often degraded by enzymes within the cell. This happens more quickly in bacteria because mRNA is not only produced at a higher rate in bacteria because they are produced in the cytoplasm and do not move out of the nucleus as they do in eukaryotic cells like our cells. But this process still takes place in multicellular organisms where, after going through all this work and all this editing to make this mRNA sequence, it gets to the cytoplasm and gets marked for ET. And by editing, I mean it gets broken up and taken into small parts again. This is also how siRNA works. If you're not familiar with siRNA, siRNA stands for small interfering RNA. These RNA sequences enter the nucleus, target mRNA for degradation by adding this little signal to specific genes, and this causes the mRNA to be knocked down. Knocked down means that these sequences do not make it to translation and do not eventually become proteins. This is a really useful tool in a lot of laboratory environments if you want to see what a specific gene does, and even more, what a specific gene does in each cell. You take that gene out and see what changes. What is upregulated in other genes, what is downregulated, how levels of mRNA change, things like that. So let's say your mRNA is lucky enough, avoids, you know, the enzyme hitman out to get it, and finally makes it to a ribosome. A ribosome is a small mix of RNA itself and protein, which translates mRNA into protein at last. So it does this by recognizing sequences of three amino acids. So that's sequences of any of those four nucleotides we mentioned earlier. So it could be AUG, ATG, CCY. Kidding about the Y. That's not a nucleotide. Watch it. There's only four. So things like GCA, all the way down the line, it can recognize these three little snippets and link them with the right amino acid to finally make the sequence of your protein. These also provide another area in which DNA can be regulated. So these mRNAs sometimes can undergo modifications, as we mentioned earlier, where they add a tail or a cap, have different introns and exons, and some of these modifications actually affect translation by ribosomes, or at the very least, the rate of translations by ribosomes. So mRNA lacking these modifications or having specific modifications, even if they reach the ribosome and do not get degraded, may still not be translated into protein. Ribosomes use the sequence of mRNA, as mentioned earlier, to determine the order of amino acids in a protein, they actually take in another type of RNA, tRNA, which brings in these amino acids into the ribosome, drops off their amino acids, forms a chain, and then at the other end, you get a unfolded protein amino acid strain shot out of the ribosome. These ribosomes also have another very cool skill. They can be directed to certain areas of the cell. For example, if a mRNA sequence comes in that has a little signaling marker that says, take me to the Golgi apparatus for modifications, or more commonly, the ER, this little signal will go to a protein on the ER, connect with the signaling molecule, and then it will move the amino acid sequence directly into the ER. And these are called little tags. And these later can move through the ER and direct modifications by enzymes either within the organelle or sometimes even within the cytoplasm. So even after the ribosome has successfully translated all these little sequences into a protein, it does not mean that the work is done. The protein still has to be correctly folded. So proteins can be folded by chaperones, which are helper proteins. They can also be cleaved, which means part of them are removed, and often undergo chemical modifications such as the addition of carbohydrates or lipids, also known as fats. So these proteins are not necessarily in an active state, and after modifications, they can become so. So for example, you might have a protein come out, which is insulin, but you need to lop off one end so that that enzyme can be active and can start digesting glucose. These proteins can also be marked for export from the cell, and further, proteins can be degraded almost instantaneously after being made. Why on earth would a cell want to go through all this work just to degrade a protein? Why wouldn't it regulate this earlier? Well, many scientists support the idea that proteins are degraded instantly because it helps to slow reactions, regulate metabolism, and most importantly, remove malformed proteins from a cell. Misfolded or mistranslated proteins have been linked to Alzheimer's and many different kinds of cancer. So it's very important that even though you've just invested all this energy to make a protein and then invest more energy to take it instantly apart, it netly creates a good effect in the cell and improves regulation of proteins within the cell. So, to go over this real quick, first you start with DNA, which has a set blueprint of amino acids. This DNA is then transcribed into mRNA, which is a similar sequence. This can also undergo certain modifications later. So these processed mRNA is then moved into translation. Translation occurs when mRNA is matched with a tRNA, which then forms a sequence of amino acids forming a protein. And then these proteins go out and are modified or degraded as appropriate for the cellular environment, and then go to work in the cell and accomplish everything the cell needed. This is known as the central tenet of molecular biology. Now you know. We're going to take a quick musical break, and as soon as we come back, we're going to talk about the world news and the Nobel Prize winners for the rest of our show. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Splice with Tortula here on radio.dominican.edu.
City Lab, get on your feet. Baby, your cellular can
construction has DNA instructions for base simple code directs at peptide production. Quick spain is deduction, started from induction. A simple path to follow, DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
the central dogma song. From DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
it's almost never wrong.
Never wrong.
Hydrogen bonds, C to G and T to A, double-stranded DNA, backbone sugar phosphate, two nucleotide base, negative charge but don't hate, information they relate, in control of your traits, replication, it makes a DNA copy semi-conservative, and it's not that sloppy, but just in case, we got some exonuclease. Haters get mad cause I got DNA polymerase. Baby, your cellular construction has DNA instructions for base simple code directs to peptide production. Quick spain is deduction, started from induction. A simple path to follow, DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
the central dogma song. From DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
it's almost never wrong. In transcription, we unwind with helicase, RNA polymerase, TTU we replace, single-stranded RNA, add a cap in poly-A to the cytoplasm, from the nucleus away, subunits of ribosome, surround it and read it, tRNA they need it, initiation sites lead it, to translate triplet code, UGA is stopped. And AUG is go,
yep.
And AUG is go,
yep.
Baby, your cellular construction has DNA instructions for base simple code directs a peptide production. Quick spain is deduction, started from induction. A simple path to follow, DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
the central dogma song,
dogma song, dogma song.
From DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
it's almost never wrong,
never wrong.
The DNA's like TAC, CGT, TCT, GCT, TAT, GGG, ACT.
The complements like ATG,
GCA, AGA, CGA, ATA, CCC, TGA.
The RNA's like AUG, GCA, AGA, CGA, AUA, CCC, UGA.
Amino A's like M, A, double R, I, P, stop. Baby, your cellular construction has DNA instructions for base simple code directs a peptide production. Quick spain is deduction, started from induction. A simple path to follow, DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
the central dogma song,
dogma song,
dogma song. DNA to RNA,
RNA to protein,
it's almost never wrong,
never wrong.
Welcome back. You're listening to Splice with Trotula here on radio.dominican.edu. It is currently 6:30 and we're going to cover the world news as well as science news and the Nobel Prize winners along with my Journal Club Junior of the Week, a very cool paper from Nature. So stay tuned to Splice. So to begin with, world news. You probably have not avoided the news that Steve Jobs passed away at age 56 this week after battling pancreatic cancer. Jobs has been credited for pioneering the basis for Silicon Valley and the Silicon Valley culture, as well as transforming Apple and Apple computers and products, and serving as CEO and financier for Pixar Animation from its humble beginnings. In other news, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is currently running for president of Liberia, Lema Gbowee, and Tacu Karman, all won jointly the Nobel Peace Prize for their nonviolent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peace-building work. Congratulations, women. Keep working for peace, for justice. And for prestigious awards, not really, but congratulations again. I know this probably did not come without political movements and some behind the stage arguments, but congratulations again. In other news, not so peaceful, violence broke out again in Cairo, Egypt. A curfew was enforced and the cabinet will hold an emergency meeting today to discuss future actions. In California news, the California Dream Act, which allows illegal immigrant college students to access state-funded financial aid, was signed into law. In case you haven't heard, the Federal Dream Act failed to pass the Senate last year. Now on to science news. First science news story of the week. Huntington's disease causes movement disorder, damage to nerves, and leads to a decreased ability to reason. It was also one of my top five most interesting genetic disorders that I covered 2 weeks ago. Well, we have some more information to add to this disease of interest. Huntington's disease in patients has shown to create higher levels of expression of a gene called H2AFI. Patients treated with a drug that slows the effect of Huntington's disease also showed reduced levels of H2AFI. This is important because it can help create accurate measures for clinical trials. This means that even though currently Huntington's disease is incurable, these treatments can be better assessed and compared to one another. Second science news story. Believe it or not, our mind keeps working during even very tedious tasks. Volunteers were interrupted in a recent study and interviewed during tedious lab tasks, and anyone who works in a lab might, you know, recognize what these would be: pipetting, incubating, running gels, ELISAs, multiple washes from Western blots. So during these tedious lab tasks, I believe probably somewhere in the same building as the people who just published these studies, an interviewer came up during these breaks and asked them a couple questions, and participants reported that they had moments of spontaneous thinking about planning and defining personal goals. So maybe during these really tedious, repetitive tasks, there's a portion of your brain that keeps thinking and thinking and thinking and working out problems, even large, maybe even existential problems in the background that you're not quite aware of. So pipette away, fellow science soldiers, pipette away. And maybe you'll wake up tomorrow after a long day in lab and have a sense of purpose and goal. And finally, our last news story before we visit the Nobel Prize winners for this year. A small fold called the paracingulate sulcus near the front of the brain has been related to the ability to differentiate memories of what we imagine to happen and what really happened. So this little indent in your brain helps you to regulate and store ideas of what happened and what only seemed to happen in your imagination, even though you can have a lot of the similar sense inputs, such as you might imagine a unicorn and you could picture the unicorn in the brain as if you had seen it, but you didn't really. Scientists believe that this little fold may be linked to psychological conditions like schizophrenia, where a blurring of the real and imagined occurs. So things where you hallucinate may actually be a result of a misfolding of the brain. This trait, however, has multiple factors, and it can be present in both, neither, or only one of your hemispheres. So have no fear if your left one is missing this, your right one seems to be able to make up the difference and allow you to store memories without getting confused between reality and imagination. So keep imagining, and if you have an infinite amount of time and not very fearful of hospitals, you might want to try to get your brain scanned, see if you have this fold. Could explain some things, some memory issues, or maybe a lack of memory issues. Finally, our main story, the Nobel Prize winners. Our first category is chemistry. Chemistry was won this year by Israeli researcher Dan Schmittman for discovering quasi-crystals. These crystals are tightly packed symmetrical patterns that repeat periodically. And they differ from normal crystals because these symmetrical patterns don't really show the same similarity of geometry at usual intervals as traditional crystals. And in fact, it was a very controversial paper when it first came out. Not a lot of scientific journals even considered publishing it whatsoever. So this is a very cool structure. It has been discovered in nature recently in Russian rivers, and people are now looking for more evidence of these quasi-crystals in other environments. So if you're interested, you can type in quasi-crystals into Google Images. That's Q-U-A-S-I crystals. And you'll see a bunch of very pretty, almost geometric pictures. And interestingly enough, they mirror a lot of Middle Eastern architectural traditions in their geometry and pattern. So very pretty. Definitely worth a brief Google search. And if you are too lazy for that, you can check out tomorrow, when it is fully up and running, the Splice website, newly designed. You can go on to Splice Up Your Life. That's spliceupyourlife.blogger.com. All one word. And I will post a picture of these quasi-crystals along with all my sources for all the information coming at you during this Splice episode, as well as some random thoughts that didn't quite make the show. So check that out starting tomorrow at spliceupyourlife.blogger.com. The next Nobel Prize winner was a Nobel Prize, were actually three Nobel Prize winners who shared the Nobel Prize in Physics this year. Those three men were Saul Perlmutter, Brian Schmidt, and Adam Riess, who all worked to discover the universe's expansion at an ever-accelerating rate. Some of you might be sitting there going, hey, wait a second. I think you said that Hubble worked on this universe expansion thing. That's very true, dear listener. Hubble did work extensively on the calculation of the expansion of the universe. And Hubble, in fact, also went on a campaign to make astronomy part of physics for consideration by the Nobel Prize Committee. He was successful, however, not soon enough to receive it during his lifetime. So, I believe all these astronomers looking at the expansion of the universe owe a great deal of thanks to Dr. Hubble. And finally, one thing I failed to mention, sadly, was that the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology recipient, Ralph Steinman, who shared it with two other scientists, actually was one of the only men to receive the Nobel Prize posthumously. So he died, unfortunately, on Friday, September 30th, before the prize was announced Monday, October 3rd. Like Jobs, he also suffered from pancreatic cancer. However, the Nobel Prize Committee decided that the small distance between the date of death and the announcement did not warrant a removal of the prize. In fact, the prize had been decided before the death, and thus Ralph Steinman was awarded it still, though this is still a slightly controversial decision within the scientific community. But congratulations to the Steinman family and the memory of Ralph Steinman. We're going to take another quick musical break, and when we come back, we will talk about our Journal Club Junior this week. Very interesting article about the possibility of reprogramming stem cells to put it to use in therapy, and a very recent advancement from a New York laboratory published in Nature. Sound interesting? Well, stay tuned. You're listening to Splice with Tortula on radio.dominican.edu. Welcome back. You're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. I'm your host, Tortula, and for the final part of our show, we're going to be holding Journal Club Junior talking about recent developments in embryonic stem cell technology and human adult stem cell technology, as well as touching briefly upon the potential of genetic engineering and what exactly is meant by artificial genes. So, to begin with, Journal Club Junior. For this week, we are going to talk about an article that was recently published in Nature. Scientists at the New York Stem Cell Foundation Laboratory have reprogrammed an adult human stem cell to an embryonic state, a feat nearly impossible, or at least thought so, thought completely impossible by some for many years. Until this paper. So conventionally, you take a cell that has gone through mitosis, usually the female's egg. So as we talked about briefly in our first show about genetics, the reproductive process scrambles chromosomes, and then each egg ends up with one chromosome, which in normal reproduction will be ultimately united with another pair of chromosomes from your father or your mother, depending on whose original cell we're talking about. However, to traditionally clone an animal, scientists would remove all the chromosomes, so that one half of a full DNA, and then insert a new chromosome to create an animal, to create that genome. So instead of getting a second set, you'd actually have the set that's present removed, and then artificially a complete another set from a different cell put in. This has been tried repeatedly with human stem cells. However, all efforts to put in adult DNA into these eggs has failed. These researchers at New York University, however, did a different technique and decided not to remove the DNA from the cell at all, but rather just insert the DNA with the chromosomes that were already present. So this means that instead of having your normal two sets of chromosomes, this cell had three. the original one set, which comes from a reproductive cell, and then two from the adult cells. This shockingly showed that the cell had characteristics of normal stem cells. So this provides a good hope, I would say a good hope to at least say that it's not impossible for adult genes to eventually be again programmed into stem cells. This means that there's a lot of applications. For example, one of the hopes is that you can take an egg, remove the genes, and put in adult genes, and thereby create a perfect source of donor cells for genetic therapies. So in this scenario, you'd have a pluripotent cell, which could turn into any type of tissue, created to exactly mirror your own genetics. And then from here, scientists or researchers could either inject those cells directly into your body to replace damaged tissue, or try to construct a new organ for you. So even though there is an extra set of chromosomes, the research team is optimistic and hopes to move on forward with this and work to create a set system where, by going through a specific series of operations, this extra set of chromosomes can be removed while still keeping the embryonic pluripotent nature of the cell with the new adults. However, before you get your hopes up too much, because there is a third set of chromosomes and the DNA is not exactly the same as that of the host gene donor, it means that unfortunately your body would reject these cells with their third set of chromosomes, and the research is still a long, long way from having any sort of real implications for healthcare. You can check that story out in the Nature Journal this month. And to wrap up our last couple minutes of the show, we're going to talk a little bit about genetic engineering. Genetic engineering is the altering of traits by changing the genetics of an organism, usually by introducing a new hereditary characteristic often borrowed from another organism. So, for example, if you want a corn that is resistant to cold, you might take a wheat adapted to the cold, so maybe crop from Russia, mix it with your corn, and have a corn that is more resistant to the cold, but still has a similar flavor or a similar color as your American corn, and thus this new trait is introduced. This has also been used to introduce pesticides and other sort of disease resistance into plants. It is still controversial for many reasons. Many people think it is a danger. A lot of people think that introducing these unknown proteins into the plants will cause health effects that have not been shown yet, and further an issue of gene patenting. Can you actually patent a certain sequence of DNA? And the next potential thing to talk about with genes, and now that you know all about how the sequence of DNA affects the expression of genes into proteins, you might be wondering, well, can we just make a sequence? Actually, we can. Artificial genes can be programmed now and placed into cells. Artificial genes are synthesized genes or genetic sequences that do not have a template sequence. This means that out of the vast expanse of people's imaginations or research or time or inclination even, they can make a new sequence of DNA and then use this new sequence to make a brand new protein. While this might sound very cool, it has some even better actual real-world applications. Artificial genes have been used in vaccine development. Further, they have been used in gene therapy to try to replace faulty genes. And lastly, they have been used in molecular engineering to produce new proteins that can help to create structures or aid damage structures. So I hope you know all about genetics now from the molecular level. We'll talk how this specifically affects stem cells next week here again on Splice. I'm Trutula. It is around 6:51 as we wrap up. And I hope you join me again on radio.dominican.edu next week. Stay tuned for the Hot Spot with DJ Juice, the Power Hour with Sam I Am, and the 9 o'clock Lounge with Too Mellow. All coming up here on radio.dominican.edu on Monday night, one of the best listening nights here on Dominican, if I do say so myself. And in a quickly established Splice tradition, we'll be ending the show with the song Science is Real by They Might Be Giants to remind you that science is indeed real, and hope to see you next week. From the beginning.